Foyer, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All witnesses before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. Blood to the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Davis. We're here today in the matter of Charlotte Relaford, docket number 13-3048. We were in the this beautiful courtroom because ours is under some renovation at this time. Would counsel of the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Your Honor, Andrew Cardi from Brown Rudnick on behalf of the appellant, Mrs. Charlotte Relaford.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Gore for the Secretary. With me at counsel's table is Jessica Swartz, Acting Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you very much. Are both parties ready to proceed? Just say it for the record.
Yes, sir.
And the government, you ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Cardi, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I request 10 minutes of rebuttal time.
You have it, and you may proceed.
Thank you.
As you begin, we're looking at kind of three issues here. One is whether VA could unilaterally process a 5121A, little a, claim as a claim for substitution. If they can't do that, do we have jurisdiction over the 5121 little a, or is it still sitting out there? And third is, assuming we do, is there any prejudice? So why don't you discuss that first issue?
Okay, the first issue, Your Honor.
Before you start, how'd you get out of New York?
Yeah, good question.
I took a train on Monday to play it safe, even though New York didn't really get too much snow. But
all right. Well, I'm glad you made it.
Let the record reflect that we appreciate that, given the particularly since we're not in our own courtroom, et cetera. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you had mentioned, the first issue here is whether the VA has the ability to unilaterally transform a claim for accrued benefits into a substitution claim. And I think the answer is clearly it doesn't. If you look first at...
Well, let me just ask. The record does not reflect any notification to the appellant that they had a choice, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. If you look at the statute, section 38 U.S.C. section 5121 big A, it says that a claimant may file a request for substitution. And so here, Mrs. Relaford never filed a request for substitution. Mrs. Relaford filed a claim for accrued benefits approximately 2 months after the veteran died. 3 years later, the VA sent her a letter, and as the VA says, they construed this claim as a claim for substitution. They don't have the power to do that. And so Mrs. Relaford had...
But they did tell her she could submit additional evidence or waive that, right?
They did, Your Honor. But again, they never told... Well, they never told her that as a direct consequence of this decision by the VA, that the VA's position was that it would now be able to obtain additional evidence. And more to the point, Mrs. Relaford still, she never made the affirmative decision to seek substitution. And that's what the statute requires.
Mr. Cardi, but isn't, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Isn't, wasn't the whole point to help the claimant to get additional medical evidence? I mean, didn't the VA do that really to assist the claimant?
Your Honor, I would say that the intent behind 5121 Big A absolutely is to help claimants. But as the Chief Judge noted in his Breedlove concurrence, there may well be legitimate reasons why an accrued benefit claimant doesn't want to pursue substitution. Perhaps there's an adverse board opinion that they would rather have vacated than step into the shoes of the veteran. And that's precisely why it's the claimant's decision. And here, that decision was not made by the claimant. It was made by the VA. It was foisted upon the claimant, and she had no say-so in the matter.
Got it. On what basis, given the record that we have, which is an appeal to this court with no reversal sought, only a request for additional medical examinations, and you can classify that order as you want. What basis would she want to go with an accrued benefits claim instead of the developed claim? Why would she not have chosen substitution? Why didn't the secretary pick the processing that was most favorable, most likely to get an award?
Well, I don't know why the VA decided to pursue substitution.
I'm actually asking the question, what reasonable person would have said don't process it further, given that it's already been denied and the only thing we sought at the court was additional medical exams?
Ms. Rutherford may well have looked at the record and said, you know what, I would rather pursue this claim based on the evidence in this file as it is now. I don't think any reasonable person could have known that the VA's construction, that the way that they interpreted 5121 Big A, they would be able to now go out and get additional medical opinions 3 years after a veteran had died. Had she known that, she may well have said, you know what, I would rather just go with what we have in the record. As this court found, the February 2003 addendum was inadequate, and perhaps Mrs. Rutherford said, you know what, we have the December 2002 medical opinion, and I would rather just go with that and the other evidence in the record. I don't want any other evidence to be adduced or obtained by any party, and I don't have any other evidence that I would like to submit.
What basis would she think she'd get a favorable award?
Based on the evidence in the record.
Which was already denied.
Yes, and
veteran represented by counsel never sought reversal based on that record.
Correct, Your Honor, but it was denied in large part because of that February 2003 addendum. And I think that this court's opinion in December 2008 very clearly said, look, this is inadequate. The circumstances in which it was obtained are...
So they'd have to reassess it in the context of the addendum and the comments of the court on the addendum.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, if the appellant in this case has merely filed a claim for accrued benefits, what relief can the court grant other than to vacate the board decision, dismiss the appeal, and we don't have a board decision before us deciding the accrued benefits claim?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you absolutely could do what you just said, in which case the claim would go back through the mechanism that it always should have gone through, which is 5121, and it should be processed as anew as an accrued benefits claim.
Did you ask the Secretary to do that?
I did not, Your Honor.
Because there's a significant amount of case law that says when there's a claim still standing out there, you ask them to process it.
Your Honor, an accrued benefits claim, as this court has recently held, is a separate and distinct claim from a veteran's claim.
So it's still standing there.
Well, Your Honor, the deadline for filing an accrued benefits claim, as Your Honor knows, is 1 year after the veteran dies. The VA's position here is that Mrs. Rutherford doesn't have an accrued benefits claim.
I understand that, but your position is that she has an accrued benefits, that's all that she filed, and you processed something known as a substitution claim. So my accrued benefits is still sitting there.
Unprocessed. The claim is unprocessed.
Yes. But I'd also note that, I'm sorry, did you say that we had filed a substitution claim?
No, they processed
yes.
The substitution
Correct.
Claim.
Correct.
And you point out in the reply brief that the Secretary is somewhere in winterland and not recognizing what you're saying, which is that, hey, I have an accrued benefits claim. You processed a substitution claim. I never asked you to do it. You never gave me any information to do it. So why don't you process my accrued benefits claim?
Correct. And that would be one way to handle this matter. And I think that would be fair and that would be just under the circumstances.
So it's still there to be processed, and we would not have jurisdiction over that claim at this point.
At this point, no, Your Honor. I don't believe that you would.
Okay.
Counselor, let me address a previous statement by you. You indicated that VA decided basically to continue to process this case, but that kind of overlooks the remand that this court issued in 2008. And, in fact, the veteran, in fact, specifically requested additional development at that time, did he not?
He did, Your Honor.
And so VA was in the spot of this court having remanded and say process this some more. in conformance with the veteran's desire, we're not doing anything.
Your Honor, this court issued an order in December 2008 that said that a medical examination with respect to the veteran was necessary. And that was with respect to the veteran's claim. This claim that we're talking about here is not the veteran's claim. The December 2008 opinion in no way affects Mrs. Rutherford's accrued benefits claim.
But she hasn't filed a claim, has she?
She has. In June of 2009, she filed an accrued benefits claim. And then 3 years later, the VA sent a letter saying that they had construed this, as they put it in their brief, as a claim for substitution. And according to the VA now, she has no accrued benefits claim. All she has is the veteran's claim. She has stepped into the shoes of the veteran, and now we're here.
Okay, that was filed in June of 2009?
June of 2009, yes.
I think you had in your brief some arguments that the current board decision had reasons and basis error. With regard to the claim for substitution, which was not filed but was construed that way by the secretary, erroneously in your position, so they processed this claim, are you now walking away from that entirely? In other words, you want to go with the accrued benefits date of death claim and not a substitution claim? The reason I'm asking is, if you go with the date of death accrued benefits, you get the date of death determination to be made on that record, and we can discuss prejudice and whether we ever, if we have jurisdiction over that, we're still discussing. But on your substitution claim, if you have raised errors that you wanted to discuss to say, no, actually, we'll go with the substitution claim, you haven't argued that, so I don't think, but I want to get it clarified. We'd rather have it remanded and another medical exam, or there's something wrong with that medical exam. You are totally walking away from the substitution.
No, Your Honor. I would say that...
Because you can't have both.
Correct, Your Honor. And in with that regard, she filed a claim for accrued benefits, and yes,
The board decision with regard to the substitution claim is regardless of the errors in there, it's not the substitution claim that you want. You want the accrued benefits claim.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Correct, Your Honor. And I do want to note there was a prior opinion from the board. I'm sure that it will come up, and I'd like to address it now. And this is the July 2012 opinion in which the board found that Mrs. Rutherford had met the requirements for substitution. There are a couple of issues I want to address there. First,
what would you want to address in that? Because you couldn't have appealed that at the time.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think we could have.
That's what I'm saying. You couldn't have appealed it
correct,
at the time.
Correct.
Is that your only point?
Yes.
We
yes.
agree.
Yes. And I'd also like to note that there are regulations now that were enacted as the VA had notified the court. There are regulations that govern 5121 Big A. A couple of things there. One, those regulations were not in effect at the time that any of this occurred. And so they're not an authority in this case. Moreover, I understand that the regulations now state that any accrued benefits claim will be construed as a claim for substitution. I don't know if that's
proper. But don't they also say that the appellant will be given notification that they don't have to do that?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Was that regulation out before the briefing in this case?
The regulation was enacted after the briefing.
Okay.
It was finalized in September and enacted in October. After we had filed all of our papers.
So we'll get the Secretary's position on all that when he's...
And there's also in the Secretary's brief, he had mentioned that there was a FAST letter that explained how mechanically substitution might work. Again, that's not binding on the claimant, and that was not published until August 2010, more than a year after Mrs. Rutherford had filed her accrued benefits claim.
You're talking about the 1030 FAST letter?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And so with respect to prejudice and with respect to harm, the simple fact is this. If Mrs. Rutherford...
Well, do we even get there, actually? I mean, I'm going to let you talk about it, but before you do, I think you conceded that conceded maybe is overstating it, but do we have jurisdiction over the other claim, the 5121 little a?
The accrued benefits claim?
Yeah, because I presume if we don't have jurisdiction over the 5121 little a, then the prejudice is you never even had a decision on the 5121 little a.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. As of right now, if that's not right, that claim is not right for this court. It should, what the court should do is basically instruct the VA to process that claim as it was filed and as it should have been processed from the very beginning, which is as an accrued benefits claim.
What should we do with the substitution claim?
There was no substitution claim. Mrs. Rutherford never filed a claim for substitution. She never requested substitution.
I understand, but that's what's been processed, and that's why you're here.
Correct.
So what would you suggest we do with it?
I think that that needs to be vacated.
Okay.
I do want to briefly address.
What if we were to find that it was the accrued benefits claim process as a substitution was before the board, and the board should have recognized that, and the board erred with regard to that? Go ahead and argue your prejudice issue. Why do you see prejudice in that regard?
I see prejudice because it's very clear that if the claim was processed as an accrued benefits claim, the statute and the case law is crystal clear that the claim is based on the evidence in the file at the time of death. I don't even think the VA would contest that. And I believe in their brief they do concede that's not an issue. Instead, because this claim was construed as a claim for substitution, under the VA's interpretation of 5121 Big A, this now allows the VA, the Secretary, to adduce additional medical evidence more than 3 years after the veteran has died. This additional evidence formed essentially the sole basis for the board's determination with respect to Mrs. Rutherford's claim. Had this evidence not been considered, as it would not have been in an accrued benefits context, then the outcome very well, and I think likely, would have been different. And so Mrs. Rutherford has sustained substantial prejudice in that regard in the way that her claim was processed.
Well, whether it would have been different or not, as I understand it, the regional office would have had to make a decision on the record with the court's opinion with regard to the 2003 addendum, which has not been done. In other words, if we were to find that the board should have seen this and remanded to the regional office to process the 5121 little a, the fact that it had been denied by a board previously wouldn't be a consideration by the regional office. And in fact, the regional office would have to consider the court's comments on the 2003, I think it was, addendum.
Yes, sir.
And that has never been done.
Correct, Your Honor. And finally, if I could, if the court does determine that, in fact, substitution was proper in this context, that somehow Mrs. Rutherford does not have an accrued benefits claim anymore, I would still argue that the additional medical evidence obtained by the VA several years after the veteran had died is nonetheless not permitted in the context of this particular, I'll call it a substitution claim, if the court determines that substitution was appropriate. And the reason I say that is that the statute is very clear that 5121 Big A is focused on the survivors, on the surviving accrued benefits eligible claimants of a veteran. And the language in the legislative history, it speaks repeatedly about survivors being able to submit additional evidence, survivors being able to now process the claim more closely.
So you're saying the duty to desist does not exist?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying
unless specifically requested by the veteran.
I think that's one option, Your Honor. But I would also highlight the fact that the duty to assist in a substitution context, as recognized by the VA in the recently enacted regulations, is necessarily different in a substitution context. If you look at the...
How is it different, as they say in their regulations?
In the regulations, I believe it's subsection F3, it says that certain benefits that would be available to a veteran will not be available in substitution, and they cite, including, they give as an example, the opportunity to obtain a medical examination. And we understand why it's impossible for a substitution.
You could still get a medical opinion, I presume.
Correct, Your Honor, but.
All right, but just follow me through on this in logic. That's what I'm trying to figure out. If they said you can't get a medical examination, you just admitted you're right, they can't get it. So what part of the duty to assist are they not providing the surviving beneficiary?
Your Honor, in the context of substitution, when the veteran is no longer able to rebut, is no longer able to provide additional evidence, is no longer able to get an independent medical examination to put on his affirmative case or her affirmative case, I would argue that the duty to assist, which I think is still evolving in the context of substitution, it's not clearly defined what it is, as that regulation indicates. It says including the fact that you can't get a medical examination. So obviously there's some other differences in the duty to assist. And I would argue that the legislative history of this statute and the court's recent decision in Todd versus McDonald, where the court repeatedly says that.
It just doesn't make sense, though, does it? I mean, I can give you all this information and the secretary can't develop it. Anyway, do you have any questions? No, I'm good. We may not have to get to that issue given everything else we discussed.
Correct, Your Honor. I see that my time is just about done, unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
So given the questioning that you've just been listening to, does the court have jurisdiction over the 5121 little a claim?
Well, to give the most complete answer, Your Honor, I'd have to back up just a little bit there, if I could. It would be the Secretary's position that there is no currently existing Section 5121 rather, claim for accrued benefits that remains extant, separate and distinct from the Section 1110 claims that are currently before the court and to which Ms. Relaford has been substituted.
So then let me ask you this. I've been advised that your current regulation says that the appellant will be given a choice with regard to a 5121 little a or a big A. Was this appellant given the choice?
Subsequent to the regional office's recognition of Ms. Relaford's accrued
benefits. She was recognized as, I mean, let's not play games. She was recognized and processed as a substituted appellant, but was she ever advised that she had a choice? Was there ever any information here as to the differences between the two?
She was advised that she had the opportunity to waive the submission and development.
Well, where did that say that she was advised that the secretary wouldn't develop additional evidence? I know what you're talking about. I read it. But you want to check it? You're not sure? It doesn't say anything about the secretary developing or not developing, does it?
No, that is true. Right?
So do you believe she had any kind of adequate notice with regard to the fact that you were processing this solely as a substitution while she still had a right to ask that it be processed only as an accrued benefits?
I believe so, Your Honor. To the extent it's a question of whether she had noticed that VA would be developing additional evidence, I think the record is abundantly clear that she had.
That wasn't my question. Is there evidence in here that she had was notified that she had the right to elect an accrued, to that her claim be processed as an accrued benefits claim and not a substitution?
Specifically, Your Honor, no, it does not. Well,
okay, if the Secretary has that in his current regulations, why are you here arguing that somehow or another she wasn't entitled to that notice at the time?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Why are you arguing that she wasn't entitled to that type of notice? That it was okay for you to unilaterally, not you personally, unilaterally process this claim as a substitution claim and not give her the option to process as an accrued benefits?
Well, the answer to that question, Your Honor, lies in VA's general duty to initially, whenever VA receives any sort of claim, it's VA's duty to liberally construe that claim to make sure that it adequately understands what benefit is being sought. That's been made clear abundantly by this court in Clemens, by the Federal Circuit, in Comer, where it was explained that the VA benefit system is not a stratagem or a trap for the unwary. In a case such as this, where there's a claim for accrued benefits, it is true that there are very technical legal distinctions between the benefits that are available under Section 5121 and through the mechanism of substitution under 5121A. I believe it's certainly fair to reach the conclusion that when when a survivor like Ms. Relaford submits a claim, she does not have those technical distinctions in mind. What the claimant is seeking, ultimately, whether it's through 5121 or through 5121 Cap A, is that the survivor is seeking a resolution of the veteran's pending
claim. Right, but, I mean, I understand your argument, and I don't think anyone – I'm not going to speak for counsel, except that the secretary was trying to do what he thought was the best. Just accept that.
That's
the fact is, she had a 5121 little a claim, and you processed it as a 5121 big A claim, and you never gave her the option.
It's true, Your Honor. It was not specifically explained to her that she had the opportunity to have that claim processed as a 5121.
Is there anything in this record that a non-lawyer surviving spouse would have understood in any way, shape, or form that, geez, I could have had a decision on the claim as it existed, or I could choose that you continue to develop it? Is there anything in this record that reflects that?
No, Your Honor. That specific distinction was not adduced.
Right. So if we were to find that the 5121 little a is still out there, do we have jurisdiction over it?
To the extent should the court find that there is a separate and distinct 5121 claim that still exists, no, there would not be jurisdiction over that claim. Because
what about the case law that indicates that the board should have recognized that the claim was there and remanded it?
If the court were to find that it was a separate and distinct claim, then jurisdiction, if you will, would be limited to a finding that the board erred in not adjudicating that claim.
So that's another possibility.
That would be a possibility.
Depending on how the facts come out and all.
But
you can argue on both of those, fine. If you're not prepared, I understand.
The answer to the question, Your Honor, would be that if there is a separate 5121 claim, the remedy would be to direct the board to in turn direct the RO to adjudicate that claim. However,
well, there's two lines. One is we potentially had jurisdiction, in which case we could do that. And the other is it just sits out there. It never got to the board, wasn't reasonably raised, and we don't have jurisdiction.
Well, the
and then we don't do that. We just tell the appellant to go tell you to process it.
Well, the claim certainly would be reasonably raised, Your Honor, in as much as VA's policy has been since the advent of 5121 Cap A to recognize claims such as a Form 21-534, as we have here, as either a 5121 standalone claim or as a request for substitution. But again, I would just...
All right, so just to clarify, the Secretary's view is that the board should have recognized that there was a 51 little a claim and should have remanded it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. That would be the Secretary's position in the event that the court were to find that there is, in fact, a Section 5121 standalone claim, which it's the Secretary's position that there is not a separate and distinct 5121 claim here. And that is because, as I was beginning to explain earlier, again, the point or the benefit that's being sought here with an accrued benefits claim is the survivor seeks a resolution of the veteran's pending claims and seeks to collect the periodic monetary benefits flowing from the resolution of that claim. There's two mechanisms by which that can be achieved.
Now, just for my two cents, without holding to this, strikes me that the Secretary may have been able to say every 5121 little a is now processed as a 5121 big A. I mean, they may have been able to say that. But you're totally recognizing there's two independent claims.
No, Your Honor, you've asked what the remedy would be in the event that there were...
No, the Secretary is recognizing that there's two independent. One is a 5121 big A claim for substitution that allows you to develop the record, and one is a 5121 little a that goes on the record as it exists. They are two separate claims. At the end of the day, it's the same benefit, but you've got arguments in here all over the place about how counsel's missing the point about it's accrued benefits. The fact is you have two claims, do you not?
Legally, there are. They are distinct claims, but the point is that the two distinct claims do not exist distinctly and independently on this record any longer.
Because you merged them.
Well, not merged, Your Honor, so much as I was beginning to explain, there's two routes to reach the same benefit, which is a resolution of the veteran's underlying claims and to resulting in a potential award.
Okay, counsel, I'm a country lawyer. I just like to talk about some plain concepts here. 21-534
from Florida.
Well,
he's the country.
Yeah, there's country in Florida in the interior.
21-534 is a claim for accrued benefits. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's a form, yes. Right? And that form was submitted, right?
That's correct.
As I looked at the record, there's nothing on that form that says anything about substitution. Would you concede that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So how do we get from the submission of an accrued benefits claim to that being treated as a substitution claim without either ignoring the accrued benefits claim or merging the accrued benefits claim and not advising the claimant that there was a choice? But the first question is, how do we get there? Why does the VA do that when you receive the form that asks for accrued benefits?
And thank you for asking that, Your Honor. The way that we get there is quite simply that VA has a duty to do that. As it is well settled that VA has a duty, as I mentioned, to liberally construe claims in the most liberal fashion to assure that that claims get the benefits that they're seeking. Here, as I mentioned, we have two different mechanisms to reach the same end. One is, as Congress clearly explained, one is inefficient, one is and quite frankly unfair. That's the traditional Section 5121 method of resolving a veteran's
pending
claim.
So you take the choice away from the claimant?
It's,
and you decide whatever is submitted, you treat it however the hell you want to treat it.
I wouldn't characterize it that way.
No, but I just did. So you treat it any way you'd like to.
Well, VA treats the claim in the manner that is best for the claimant, which here the contrast is between one mechanism that Congress very clearly explained in the legislative history of 5121 Cap A is a slow, inefficient, and unfair statutory mechanism, and they specifically created a remedy to that to remedy the inequities as between living veterans and their survivors as between 5121 and 5121A. They created a much more fair, much more liberal, much more efficient route for them to pursue those benefits, and VA simply presumes that claimants will want the benefit of Congress's remedy, that they will want to be able to start to pick up where the veteran left off, to step into his shoes, and that they will want to submit additional evidence rather than being forced into the unfair restrictions of Section 5121. As Chief Judge Castle mentioned, VA is simply trying to do the best for the claimant here. And that's all
that happened. I understand that, and that's all well and good, but you're doing that without any input to the claimant, right? I mean, I understand the paternalistic system and all that, and it's all good for the veteran and now the spouse of the deceased veteran, but it bothers me that there is, it sounds like to me, an automatic process that the government goes through that simply says, whatever you submit, we'll treat it the way we want to treat it. It's to your benefit, maybe, but we'll treat it the way we want it to be treated. Does that strike you as being fair to the claimant?
It does, Your Honor, where as I explained, we have two statutory mechanisms, one of which is as a matter of law, if you will, unfair and inefficient, and the other is eminently more fair and more efficient and provides significantly greater benefits both procedurally and substantively. I don't think that it's unfair at all to presume that that a claimant would prefer the more fair, more efficient method.
So then do I hear you saying at some point you're about to do away with accrued benefits claims?
No, Your Honor. Section 5121 remains very much extant. There are, of course, two sides to the 5121 coin, so to speak. The first being where there are simply benefits that are due and a check has not been written. In order for a survivor to obtain those benefits that are just simply, that are already owed, there's already an award, VA is simply looking for a payee. That would, of course, be the province of Section 5121. The other side of that coin is where a veteran dies leaving pending claims, and that is where 5121 Cap A steps in and provides a much more efficient and facilitative route for survivors to vindicate those rights.
If the claimant requests that.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
If the claimant requests that, it seems to me.
It is a splitting hair, it's not whether they request it so much as whether they've waived it, but I understand that does reach the same issue of a waiver. But again, VA presumes, and reasonably, I think, that a claimant will want the more facilitative, fair, and efficient route
That's not what Mr. Carty is telling us.
That's true. That's not what we're hearing here today. But I would submit that we wouldn't be having this conversation if the result of the August 2012 VA examinations came back differently. I can't think of a situation where a claimant would not want the ability to submit additional evidence in support of their claim. Indeed, that's exactly what Congress recognized in creating 5121 Cap A, that it's patently unfair to prohibit survivors from submitting evidence in support of claims that the veterans could otherwise have submitted. And we're here today ultimately because the assistance that VA provided, regrettably, it resulted in an unfavorable medical examination. However, the point is that's incidental, Your Honor. The point is that VA was attempting to assist in developing evidence and substantiating the claim, and moreover, pursuant to an order of this court. And that's all that was done here is VA construed this claim in the most liberal fashion possible to afford Mr. Relford all the rights that Mr. Relford would have had he not died. And I don't see any unfairness in that, and quite frankly, I think that it's entirely in keeping with VA's duty to liberally construe claims to have a process in place that presumes that choice on the part of a claimant.
Counselor, Judge Davis, are you done?
Yes.
I don't have a bow tie on, and I am from Idaho, which is God's country. And first of all, let me say that I think we are all appreciative of the Secretary's efforts to make the process easier and more efficient in terms of a surviving spouse and the substitution. My hat is off to the individual who, in writing the new regulations, said, well, maybe not everybody fits in this category. We think we're doing the right thing, providing the duty to assist and a variety of other things. But maybe the survivor ought to have the ability to opt out of this. So my compliments to whoever thought that one up in the new regulation, because that's important, at least to me, and I believe you can see from the questioning, may be very important to the rest of us, that it's nice to have a government that looks out for you, but you want to be able to get out from under their protection at some point in time. And I can envision a surviving spouse who has just gone through a lengthy illness with a veteran who expires, and she is told or he is told that they have the opportunity to continue with this process that they've been involved with probably for several years, just saying, I don't want to. You know, just give me my benefits claim as a survivor and get me out of this process, because I'm tired of dealing with it emotionally and mentally. So the opt-out provision is very important, I think, to me, and I think also to my colleagues. Just carry that message forward, if you would, please.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So I want to focus on prejudice for a second. And as I understand this case, the regional office had denied it. The board had denied it. It was appealed to the court. Reversal was not sought. Additional medical examinations were the basis of the appeal, and it was remanded for additional medical examinations or the board to explain why not needed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the 2003, with regard to hypertension, addendum was deemed by the court as inadequate.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at that point, shortly thereafter, the veteran dies.
In April 2009, yes, Your Honor.
Take 5121 Big A off the books for a second. What is the right of the surviving spouse, accrued beneficiary, at that point without 5121 Big A? What would have happened?
In the absence of 5121 Cap A, Your Honor, what would have happened subsequent, you're asking subsequent to this court's remand.
Subsequent to this court's
remand. As of the
date of death.
As of the date of death.
Filed within a year.
Yes, assuming the claim is otherwise as it were here. The right of Ms. Relford would have been to have an adjudication by the regional office based on whatever evidence was in the file as of April 2009, which at that point would have included the December 2002 examination with respect to hypertension, and it would have also included the February 2003 addendum to that examination, as well as this court's comments regarding the inadequacy of that. However, VA's hands would indeed be tied with respect to remedying it, the inadequacy of that, because, of course, any
So at VA, I guess what I'm going to get to is she would be entitled to a decision on her claim, assuming it's her.
Yes.
And the fact that she had been denied, that the veteran had been denied in the regional office, been denied at the board, had a remand from this court, the regional office would render an independent initial determination on her claim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's not an automatic denial.
It would not be an automatic denial, no.
So there might, I suppose someone, I mean, it might be hard to envision why someone would choose not to get additional evidence, but it's possible that someone might say on that record, even though they've had two denials, I'd rather go that route than have another VA medical opinion added to the file.
I'm sorry, the acoustics are...
Then have another VA medical opinion added to the file. It's possible. It's possible that a claimant, surviving spouse, accrued beneficiary, might say, even on that scenario where it's been denied twice but remanded by the court with criticism on this 2003 addendum, might say, I'd rather you decided on that file as it existed, independent. The fact it's been denied is not to be considered. Then have VA add another medical opinion to the file. It's not totally unreasonable that somebody might choose that.
It's not an impossibility, Your Honor. It's
that's the choice that the appellant here did not get, at least not a written notice of that choice.
Yes, the notice letter did not specifically outline the...
All right, so given that it's a totally independent claim, how could we find no prejudice? I'm not saying you even argued that. I don't remember right this second. But we discussed it with your opposing counsel. So how could we even find no prejudice if they were entitled to a totally independent claim? I mean, we might look at this record and say there's no way they're going to win. But they're entitled to a totally independent opinion, decision, if we find a 5121 little a.
In the event that the court finds a still currently extant 5121 claim that has not been subsumed by the substitution that has gone forward, yes, Your Honor, it is difficult not to find prejudice in as much as there is an entitlement to a separate and independent adjudication of that 5121 claim. But
I appreciate your answer.
I would just reiterate again that it's the Secretary's position and a reasonable one in my view that as explained in the FAST letter, the two are one and the same, and that they... it's simply two statutory mechanisms of reaching what amounts to the same benefit, and VA does it is reasonable and consistent with VA's duties as explained in case law and in statute and regulation to liberally construe those claims in the most fair, efficient, and facilitative means possible, and that's all that was done here, and that's all that VA's policy seeks to accomplish in treating the two claims as one and the same. Unless, if there are no further questions from Your Honors, it's the Secretary's position, as I've explained, that the Board committed no error in developing the evidence here and in relying on that evidence, and that the Board's decision should be affirmed in all respects.
Well, then I'll ask you one more, since you said the Board committed no error. If we were to choose and weigh the facts and the law between having no jurisdiction over the 5121 little a or finding Board error in not noting that the appellant did not, or the claimant at the time, was not provided notice of the option, which of the two is more supported by the record and the law?
The more supported by the record and the law here would be that the, should there be a finding that there's a still existing 5121 claim, the more supported position here would be that the Board erred in not recognizing it as much, because it is VA's policy that a 21-534 form stands as both a request for a substitution and the accrued benefits claim. So if that claim is still found to be existing, then that would be reasonably raised by the record, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Mr. Carter, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a couple of quick points. One is that this really is about the statute. If you look at Section 5121 Big A, it is clear that this is the request of the claimant. I think that it hasn't been contested at all that Mrs. Rutherford never made this request. In fact, this option was never even presented to her. And so this substitution was inappropriate and shouldn't have occurred. And I also want to address just one point that the VA had made, and I believe they said that they couldn't envision a scenario in which a claimant may not want to develop the record, and Your Honor had pointed to a scenario, and so did Judge Lance. And the Chief Judge's concurrence in Breedlove had laid this out, that, in fact, there may be instances where an accrued benefits claimant wants to pursue an accrued benefits claim, and that's why it's critical that it's their choice. And Mrs. Rutherford never had that choice here. And with that, I am closed. I'm done. So if there are any questions.
I just want to make it clear, I'm not sure that would have been the right choice here, but I think the choice exists.
Thank you.
It appears, Counselor, that you have a client who's caught in a notch somewhere between pre-existing practice and the new regulation that just came out. And the claim that was filed in June of 2009, is that extant, or that has been subsumed, according to the Secretary's view, into the existing determination? Is that correct? You filed an accrued benefits claim in June of 2009. Is that correct?
Correct, Your
Honor. Okay. And that has not been acted upon because it's been subsumed into the larger substitution issue.
That's the VA's position, yes. And it has not been acted on, and the reason is because the VA contends that it has been subsumed by substitution, by the substitute claim.
And going to the issue of the statutory language, your position is that it's at the request of the beneficiary?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right. Is the opt-out provision that is provided for in the new regulations, in your view, adequate?
I believe that the opt-out provision is, I think that that issue is clearly not before the court. I understand. I think that there are issues with it. I think that it still needs to be an affirmative request of the claimant. And I understand that there's a provision in there that says any accrued benefits claim will be automatically construed as a claim for substitution. I don't know then how you apply for accrued benefits under that statute. Do you have to affirmatively tell the VA that I do not want substitution, that I want to pursue my accrued benefits claim? I don't think that was the intent of Congress. I think that Congress wanted to, as this court has noted, provide claimant surviving potential accrued benefits claimants with two paths, and they choose the path. So automatically putting them on one route and requiring them to opt out, I think, is problematic.
Thank you.
Do you think, and I think you're right, that it may not be before the court, but I'm interested anyway. Do you think that if a claimant filed for a 5121 little a, the secretary would have a duty to notify them that they could seek substitution if it were filed within the year? I think it has to be.
I think so, Your Honor.
And so it's the notice issue.
Yes.
Do you know, and I'm not that familiar with the reg, but do you know, does the reg explain any kind of difference between the two as their process, that the 5121 little a is decided on the record while the other is developed?
I believe that it states, and I could be wrong, but I believe that it states that the survivor may be able to develop the record and submit additional evidence. But it doesn't say anything about the VA
continuing to develop it on its own?
Correct.
Okay. I'm just curious. Anybody else?
Okay. And just in closing, if there is any ambiguity as to mechanically how substitution should work, remember this happened in 2009, there were no regulations, that ambiguity should be construed in the favor of Mrs. Relaford here. And as the court said in Comer v. Peek, the VA disability compensation system is not meant to be a trap for the unwary, and Mrs. Relaford simply didn't know what was going on and never had the choice that she is entitled to under the statute.
All right, thank you very much. The case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.
All right. Get your glasses. Oh, thank you.